skeptical of politicians. Why else would they be undecided in October of an election year? He understood that there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen of Hillary's campaign and that the data drove a lot of the decision-making. But still, killing an ad with Bernie endorsing Hillary at a time when she was struggling to energize his base was a real head-scratcher. "It could have been really helpful to her," said one person who saw it. But Bernie had hammered Hillary so hard during the primary that validating her now strained his credibility more than it strengthened hers. "People felt that it was him delivering his message, not Hillary's," said one Hillary aide familiar with focus group responses. "People didn't feel that it was an authentic pitch for her and what she wanted to do. It even had some backlash in folks saying that he's not really supporting her." He'd called her corrupt. He'd called her dishonest. He had played to voters' worst fears about her and laid the groundwork for Trump to cement them. Neither side had any incentive to admit it, but Bernie never would have gotten off the ground if there wasn't significant antipathy toward Hillary Clinton within the Democratic Party. He might be able to persuade supporters who simply preferred him to back Hillary, but good luck with the people who hated her more than they liked him. Brooklyn nixed the idea of putting the ad on broadcast television, but did use some of the shorter takes Devine had filmed for digital ads targeted to particular voters. With Trump having closed the gap in polling and Hillary coming off her health scare, many Democrats were worried that she might fade at the end of the campaign. But not everyone in the party was so discomfited. On September 21st, Obama sat down with Robert Wolf, his longtime friend and donor, at the Plaza Hotel in Manhattan. The president was about to give a speech to the U.S.-Africa Business Forum, but Wolf wanted to get his sense of domestic politics. "What are you thinking about the secretary?" Wolf asked. "You know, she's going to be okay," Obama replied with typical reserve. "Don't worry." But the answer didn't satisfy. Wolf stared at Obama for a moment. "I want you to look me in the eye," the financier said. Obama locked onto Wolf. "She's got this," the president said. Chapter 17. Demeanor is the debate. Hillary folded her arms across the front of her olive suit jacket, her jaw set, her lips pursed. The swaying of her body, left, right, betrayed growing irritation. Behind thick-framed black glasses, she squinted in disbelief across the debate stage at her opponent. "Donald's plan to round up 16 million people with a deportation force is wrong," she declared. "We have limited resources. We should use them on the people who are really dangerous, who threaten our safety, not on families, law-abiding people contributing to their communities. Like the 1,000 people that should be deported that you just gave citizenship to?" her rival crowed. The moderator bailed her out. "Let's stop there." "He is so annoying," Hillary fumed. "Just unbelievably annoying. God, so annoying." It wasn't clear to the small audience watching this practice session in a conference room at the Doral Arrowwood in White Plains, New York on Saturday, October 15th, whether she meant Trump or the man who was playing him, Philippe Raines. At this point, days before the third and final presidential debate, the personality didn't matter as much as what was really unsettling her. Trump's arguments on issues at the heart of his candidacy, jobs, immigration, and trade, packed more punch than Hillary's. His words were tough and his ideas were easy to grasp. Hers were neither. That's what truly annoyed her. She was highly vulnerable to a disciplined version of Trump, one who pounded her on substance without taking her bait, even after she'd demolished the Republican nominee in two previous battles. Ever since 1960, when a calm but energetic John F. Kennedy was more appealing to voters than the wan, sweaty Richard Nixon, presidential debates had held a special appeal in American politics. They were the only chance for voters to see the candidates engage in one-on-one political combat, providing an important window into how their respective arguments stood up under direct criticism and how they handled themselves under pressure. One of the debates, or even just a single moment, had the power to make or break a candidate. Ronald Reagan questioning Jimmy Carter's hallmark honesty with the line, "There you go again," in 1980, or George H.W. Bush absentmindedly looking at his watch during a debate with Bill Clinton in 1992, for example. Hillary absolutely hated the very idea that voters' decisions could come down to a zinger or a gaffe, rather than a candidate's record, platform, or character. But she accepted the conventional wisdom that she could win or lose the presidency based on her performances against Trump, a rival who thrived on getting under the skin of an opponent. And what Reins found, as he practiced against her round after round, is that Hillary's heavily nuanced policy arguments were boring and easy to pick apart with a sharp retort. Her strength and her weakness were one and the same. She mastered so much material. As the guy who would kick her ass over and over again, it was obvious to Reins that Trump's messaging was better, said a source with singular knowledge of his thinking. Like Trump, Reins had a well-earned reputation for crossing lines of civility, even with his own colleagues. He was even more aggressive with reporters, having famously emailed BuzzFeed's Michael Hastings with the sign-off, "Have a good day," and by good day, I mean fuck off. His shtick was a mismatch for this new no-drama mantra version of Hillary Land. But Rooney, the campaign speechwriter who had first suggested he play the Donald stand-in toward the end of the primary season, thought it might be perfectly suited to this task. In a Clinton operation full of supplicating sycophants, Reins knew how to get in Hillary's face, metaphorically and literally. He'd survived in her orbit, in part because he was willing to make her uncomfortable. If she'd thought about firing him once, she'd thought about it 1,000 times, and still he maintained a direct line to her and influenced her thinking about public relations strategy as much as, if not more than, anyone else. Like so many of the friends and allies Hillary had assembled over the years, Reins had attributes that made him very useful at particular times and in certain situations. Mostly, it worked to Reins' advantage that no one else had a brilliant thought on who could portray the billionaire in a way that would actually prepare Hillary for him. Hillary had been looking for a place to put Benenson, and his name surfaced in the discussions. Jennifer Palmieri thought Anthony Weiner might be able to pull it off, but, for obvious reasons, no one else thought that was a very good idea. Sullivan championed Reins, and over the course of June and July, he normalized the idea within the upper ranks of the campaign before taking it to Hillary. She signed off with minimal hesitation. In an email sent the first Monday in August, Sullivan told Hillary's longtime spokesman he'd gotten the role. But a follow-up message contained an unambiguous admonishment. "You've got to take this seriously. You've got to get it right." Reins understood that it wasn't just important that he nailed the part, but that he convinced those on the campaign who doubted his maturity that he was taking it seriously. That was no small feat. After all, Trump himself couldn't be trusted to act like an adult in a debate. The line between accurately portraying Trump and behaving like a buffoon was particularly fine. Karen Dunn and Ron Klain, who ran debate prep sessions for Hillary, made that point on a conference call with Reins the next day. Klain, who had reservations about the campaign's most important impersonator, stressed that Trump, contrary to popular opinion, had actually put forth a lot of policy ideas. To play him right, Raines would have to study not just Trump's mannerisms, but his platform and his style of thinking. "Got it," Raines assured Klain. "I understand this is not a Saturday Night Live character imitation." Then he went to work on becoming Trump. First stop, the men's department at Nordstrom. "I need to look like Donald Trump," he told his suit guy, "but not like Halloween." A week later, he'd have a slightly baggy blue suit with high cuffs, just like the Donalds. He ordered dress shoes with 3¼-inch lifts, a backboard for his posture, and knee braces to combat his tendency to sway. He concluded that acquiring Trump's carrot skin tone would be too much of a distraction, but only after covering half his face in self-tanner one day to try it out. He bought Trump cufflinks on Amazon and a Trump watch on eBay for about $175. Raines even shelled out money for 4 podiums, 2 apiece for his apartment and an office at Clinton campaign lawyer Mark Elias's firm, so that he could do mock debate sessions with friends before he faced off with Hillary. And then there was the shackle. Worried about leaving his super-secret prep materials in an Uber, Raines bought a heavy-duty tether so that he could lock his briefcase to his wrist. He actually acquired 2 different versions, one of which was originally designed for bondage enthusiasts. On the final day of August, Dunn and Klain convened a special Trump unit in Midtown Manhattan. The space, where Hillary had held her pre-launch campaign discussions, functioned like a shadow headquarters, often reserved for sensitive projects. Getting ready for Trump and bringing Raines into a major role on the campaign both qualified. Inside the lone conference room of a white walls and glass doors office that featured dramatic views of Times Square, Dunn, Klain, Raines, and Bob Barnett went to work on getting inside Trump's thinking. They were joined by 2 special guests, Tony Schwartz, who had written Trump's best-selling book, The Art of the Deal, and financier Robert Wolf. As far back as March, with Trump starting to pull away from the Republican field, Wolf had suggested to Hillary that she bring in a few folks from the business community to help prepare her for Trump. He thought she'd benefit from understanding how the approach of a deal-maker would differ from that of a politician, and he was volunteering for duty. She responded quickly and in the affirmative. Over the course of 3 hours, Schwartz took the lead on the ins and outs of Trump's personality, while Wolf painted the picture of a businessman turned presidential debater. How would Trump turn his own negatives into her weaknesses? What would he say to shift the back and forth of policy contrasts into a negotiation? How would he frame his lines of attack on infrastructure, Brexit, China, government regulation, and wages? Raines, Dunn, Klain, and Bob Barnett, the Washington super lawyer and Hillary's agent, peppered Wolf and Schwartz with questions about the biggest wild card in American political history. As Raines listened, his confidence grew. These specialists didn't know more about Trump's policies and tendencies than he did after having watched each of the Republican primary debates repeatedly. They knew less. "I've got this down," he thought. As they walked out of the conference room, Raines turned to Klain and Dunn. "I want to do this right now," he said, brimming with brio. "Get HRC." Hillary had been in training, too. Since the primaries, her debate prep show had been run by Dunn and Klain. Hillary felt comfortable taking direction from the straight-talking Dunn, a petite brunette with shoulder-length curls. The younger woman, once described as a mini Hillary, was emotionally comforting to the candidate, said one person who participated in the sessions. She was considered a top contender for the post of White House counsel if Hillary won the presidency. Klain got frequent mention for that job and chief of staff. Together, Klain and Dunn had developed a debate prep method that was widely viewed as the gold standard in Democratic circles. They had served in the same roles for President Obama's 2012 re-election effort. Shortly after the Democratic convention, Klain, Dunn, and Sullivan, who technically oversaw them and could translate answers into Hillary speak, had traveled to the candidate's home in Chappaqua. Sitting in the living room of Hillary's carriage house, they went over the early version of a briefing book containing all the policies and political issues she would have to know cold by the time of the first go-round with Trump. This was the easy part for Hillary. Studying a briefing book, boning up on the issues, that was in Hillary's comfort zone. Public performance was always harder for her. But matching up against Trump presented a challenge far different from anything she'd experienced before on a debate stage. After all, his whole campaign was predicated on the idea that he wasn't a typical politician. For better and worse, he didn't debate like an experienced candidate. That's where Raines would come in. Her team could be sure that he would say outlandish and salacious things, yell, and point his finger to try to rattle Hillary. Her job would be to deliver her punches and deflect his attacks without losing her composure. Hillary was painfully aware of the tightropes she'd have to walk, the same ones women in politics and business always had to tread with extreme caution. She'd have to be confident without appearing arrogant, defensive without being accusatory, and assertive without looking like a bitch. But in prep sessions dating back to the primaries, her voice, her body language, and her facial expressions often betrayed the traits she wanted to avoid in prime time. Dunn was so conscious of the damage that could be done with one bad look or one sarcastic remark that she devised a mantra for Hillary: demeanor is the debate. Not only did Dunn say it, but it was featured on special one-sheet debate-on-a-page memos that she and Klain gave Hillary on the day of each of the primary and general election debates. "Happy to be there, smiling, never rattled, you look great," they wrote in one of them, under the "Don't Forget" category. "Tone, tone, tone," they put at the top of another cheat sheet. They also included coaching on which topics Hillary should hit her opponent with, how to frame particular arguments, and reminders of what she was fighting for: women, children, families, middle class, people knocked down, and what she was fighting against, including drug, insurance, and oil companies, reckless CEOs, and a deck stacked against most Americans. Even when she'd squared off against Sanders, her script called for taking shots at Trump. "Bigotry, bluster, bullying," one talking point reminded. "I was the first to stand up to him in this race." Another called for her to say, "I'm the only candidate with more votes than Trump." But style mattered most. Hillary knew she could easily turn off voters if she didn't get that right, because, as one person who knows her well put it, she was accustomed to being a woman who is scored according to how much she's smiling and what her tone is. Against Trump, her temperament would be all the more important, because it would serve as a metaphor for the contrast at the heart of her main argument against him. She was steady, and he was dangerous. If she could keep her cool and get under his skin, she would reinforce that narrative. On the other hand, she could undermine her most potent weapon if she appeared rattled by him, or even if he could match her calm and discipline. Moreover, Hillary's team believed Trump would come in with such low expectations that his performance would be considered a success if he didn't drool on his shoes. On the other hand, Hillary was supposed to shine in a format that rewarded preparation, quick recall of facts, and the ability to focus on both the answers at hand and an overall strategy. In other words, the bar was low for him and high for her. The number one rule for any debate prep team is to make sure the candidate isn't hearing, seeing, or feeling anything for the first time when he or she steps into the ring with an opponent. Because Trump was liable to say or do just about anything, that was an even bigger focus for Hillary's aides. Klain and Dunn had curated a database of all the questions that had ever been asked in general election debates. "I don't think she heard any questions for the first time," said one participant, who noted that a question Klain asked behind closed doors about a possible no-fly zone over Syria was repeated almost verbatim by moderator Chris Wallace in the third debate. The trickier piece, and this is where Raines' obsessiveness came in, was predicting the ways in which Trump's behavior could throw Hillary off her game. During one session at Hillary's debate prep nerve center inside the Doral Arrowwood, Raines casually put his fingers on the neck of his microphone while Hillary was practicing hitting Trump on failing to pay contractors. The habit, one he'd picked up by watching countless hours of Trump's primary debates, produced audio feedback. Hillary kept talking, but Raines broke in. "This mic's not working," he said. "If the mic's not working, I don't pay the guy." With one quick and odd interjection, he'd given a succinct explanation of why Trump might have good reason to stiff a contractor. Raines didn't pull it out of the sky. At a rally in January, Trump had digressed from a speech to complain about the person responsible for the sound system. "Don't pay the son of a bitch," he'd said. No detail was too small for Raines. He spent an entire day simply ignoring Hillary, even when she encouraged him to eat during a lunch break. And during sessions, he stared at an X he'd put on one wall so that he wouldn't make eye contact with her or Klain, who played the moderator. 2 days before the September 26th opening debate, Raines raised a concern. He thought Hillary should practice the traditional pre-debate handshake with Trump, because it could be a tense moment. Trump could use his physical size to get in her space and intimidate her, maybe not even out of malice, but just out of sheer awkwardness. Trump might even try to kiss her. So at 9 o'clock that night, full mocks started at the same time as real debates. Klain introduced Hillary Rodham Clinton and Donald J. Trump. As they crossed the prep stage, Raines made a beeline for Hillary with both arms extended in front of him like Frankenstein's monster. He was going in for a hug. Hillary wasn't having it. She ducked under one of his arms, a quarterback evading an oncoming pass rusher. Raines pursued, wrapping her up as she laughed at him. Through serious drills and the occasional moments of levity, Hillary's team had prepared her for everything she might encounter from Trump. But neither her mastery of the subject matter nor her attention to deportment addressed the fact that Trump's positions and his manner of articulating them were often easier to grasp than hers. "Some of his arguments were good," observed one of her aides. "Some of hers were not good." At one point, there was a belief among Hillary's advisors that it made sense to go after Trump hard on finding a way to avoid paying income taxes. It only took about 10 minutes of listening to Raines deflect questions to come to the conclusion that Hillary wasn't going to get a lot of traction from it. Even when Trump was out of line with a majority of Americans on specific policy, say, building a wall on the U.S.-Mexican border and banning Muslims from entering the country, his thrust of prioritizing the needs of American citizens first was clear. And he was good at turning his weaknesses into strengths with entertaining asides. When Hillary attacked on Trump's hiring of foreign workers at his resort, Mar-a-Lago, Raines channeled him perfectly by talking about how hard it is to get people to work in the summer heat in Florida. Arguing the first step in closing immigration loopholes is knowing where they are. If you had seen debate prep, you would see why he was the nominee, said one person who was in the room. You would not have said, this woman is going to kick his ass. During the private sessions, Hillary readied herself to defend against Trump's main attack lines, her health, conflicts of interest arising from the Clinton Foundation's work, and his call for her to be jailed without charges or trial for her email scandal, and to go on offense. The latter part of her strategy revolved around driving home three main points. Trump was the poster boy for corporate insiders screwing the little guy. His temperament was ill-suited to the Oval Office, and he was, in the words of one of her advisors, a small-minded bigot. Outside the retreat site, Hillary's post-convention bounce in the polls had eroded, washed away by her deplorables remark and her health scare. Trump taunted her from the campaign trail, contrasting her intense preparations with his seat-of-the-pants approach to training for the debates. He even rejected his advisor's entreaties to use a lectern in practice sessions so that he could get used to standing in place for an hour and a half. Trump was right that Hillary obsessed over getting ready for a debate. She had to understand everything about everything, said one of her advisors. If it was policy, she had to understand the theory behind the policy. She needed to theorize everything to the ground. Everyone thinks she's scripted, but she goes deep on every topic. Her absorption of the material made her a better debater, but could leave her sounding wooden. Another aide said she had to work hard on turning specific questions into answers on larger themes or opportunities to go on offense. The questions are supposed to be giving people a sense of how you think, this aide explained. Her instinct is to answer the question very narrowly. Those problems, her stiffness, and her inability to reply to specific questions with thematic answers, were painfully obvious in the debate prep sessions. Raines had been able to exploit them and outperform her. Heading into the first debate, held at Hofstra University on Long Island, Hillary and her team were nervous that Trump might do the same thing. As she had done before facing Bernie Sanders in the primaries, Hillary huddled with Klain, Dunn, Sullivan, and Podesta before the debate. This time, she seemed on edge. There was so much riding on a curious, nationally televised piece of performance art. It was such a poor test, she thought, of which candidate would make a better president. Normally so stoic, she betrayed the butterflies in her stomach by nervously joking with her aides about the outsized significance the debates took on. They tried to reassure her. Have fun, they advised. The winner of the debate was usually the candidate who appeared to be enjoying the moment more. By that measure, Trump was more prepared. In the pre-debate spin room, his advisors had a little hop in their step. Their guy was ascendant. They were loose and confident that he could exceed expectations. Hillary's surrogates looked like they were walking in to take the SATs. Sure, they'd prepared, but they weren't at all certain of the outcome, and their futures all depended on a high score. The big, gripping fear inside Hillary's camp was that with her sliding and Trump rising in the polls, she would falter and he would do the heretofore unthinkable, waltz under the debate stage, cool as a Klondike bar, and give the Oscar-worthy performance of a serious presidential candidate. Hillary's pre-game jitters and her penchant for slow starts intensified the clenching of jaws as the two combatants took up positions behind their respective podiums. A few minutes after 9 p.m., the concern turned to shock as Trump opened up with a calm, disciplined articulation of his plan to boost jobs, sprinkled with a toxic dose of Hillary as the status quo. This wasn't the P.T. Barnum version of Donald Trump. It was the Ronald Reagan version. When Hillary interjected with a canned line, "I call it trumped up trickle down," a collective groan echoed through the Democratic universe. Trump was fresh and on point. Hillary was a day-old bagel. He went in for the kill on trade, the issue that he hoped would deliver key Rust Belt states. "She's been doing this for 30 years," he charged. "And why hasn't she made the agreements better?" And he called out NAFTA, the pact so singularly associated with her husband. Hillary was in quicksand. "I will bring back jobs. You can't bring back jobs," Trump said. Clean, simple, to the point. Hillary countered with the mother of all establishment talking points. Independent experts agreed with her. This was a debacle. An opposite day of a debate in which a commanding Trump had Hillary on her heels and backpedaling fast. Democrats furiously sent each other worried text messages and emails. Hillary had been in free fall before the debate, and she was doing nothing to arrest it. Trump looked almost presidential. Would they look back at these early exchanges as the moment Trump won the White House? But the feeling was different in Hillary's staff holding area, a hastily converted athletic training room complete with a full skeleton behind a blue curtain. Watching one of the TVs set up at the front of the long, narrow room, Dunn and Raines were picking up a different vibe. This Hillary was holding her ground and her cool better than the one they'd prepped. More important, they could detect a shift in Trump's demeanor. He'd entered the debate subdued. But Hillary had riled him twice already, first by pointing out he'd inherited his wealth, and then by citing a tweet in which he'd called climate change a Chinese hoax. He really didn't like being quoted back to himself. They'd watched enough tape to know that. He was getting angrier, and that made him less disciplined. In an exchange over ISIS, he went to the well again on the attack that she'd been in Washington too long. "You've spent your entire adult life fighting ISIS," he charged. The unpolitician was so married to his talking point and so furious at Hillary that he wasn't making sense. After that, Trump never regained control, and Hillary never lost it. But it wasn't until very late that she landed a prepackaged punch that would stagger Trump on the stage and ring in his head for several days thereafter. In gathering research on Trump, Dunn had read a story about the billionaire real estate mogul tormenting a Miss Universe over her weight. At the time, in 1997, Trump co-owned the beauty pageant, and he didn't like that the reigning champ, Alicia Machado, had gained a few pounds. So he teased her publicly, even inviting news crews to record her at a workout. He called her Miss Piggy and Miss Housekeeping, a jab based on her Venezuelan heritage, according to Machado's account. Dunn was well aware of Trump's vile remarks about other women, fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals, as Fox's Megyn Kelly had reminded Trump during a GOP primary debate. "That's terrible," Dunn thought when she'd read about Machado during an early research session. Just terrible. So bad, it was good. For most Americans, the introduction of Machado would be a new exhibit in Hillary's case that Trump was misogynistic, anti-Hispanic, and a bully. As Hillary had practiced recounting Machado's tale during one debate prep session, Dunn had offered a suggestion. Not only should Hillary repeat Trump's sleazy sobriquets, but she should add a line at the end of her attack. "By the way, she has a name." Before the real debate, Dunn had encouraged Hillary to keep her Machado attack ready for the right moment. "You've got to do this," the younger woman said, thinking it could provide a powerful illustration of Trump's character flaws. They both understood that the rhythm, flow, and topics of a debate didn't always lend themselves easily to the lines a candidate planned to deliver, even if Hillary was determined to get to Machado, as one aide put it, come hell or high water. As the debate wound down toward its final 15 minutes, there still hadn't been a chance to bring up Machado. And then Trump got personal with Hillary. She doesn't have the look. She doesn't have the stamina, Trump said. I don't believe she does have the stamina. To be president of this country, you need tremendous stamina. Debate moderator Lester Holt had asked Trump about something he'd said on the campaign trail, that Hillary didn't have the presidential look, and clearly wanted to know whether the Republican nominee was suggesting that a woman couldn't look like a president. Trump's transition to stamina sounded like a deft pivot from gender to Hillary's health, a reminder of her fainting episode just a couple of weeks earlier. But Hillary, giving a knowing look, exploited an opening on his flank. You know, he tried to switch from looks to stamina, but this is a man who has called women pigs, slobs, and dogs, she said, to introduce her memorized paragraph on Trump's remarks about the pageant winner. Donald, she has a name, Hillary charged. Suddenly, Trump was in a box. If he said her name, he'd acknowledge he knew what Hillary was talking about. If he refused, Hillary could hit him on that. Where did you find this? Trump shouted. Where did you find this? Her name is Alicia Machado, Hillary said, with Trump trying to interrupt her. And she has become a U.S. citizen, and you can bet she's going to vote this November. Watching live in the debate hall, on screens in a room outside it, and in the Brooklyn headquarters, Hillary's allies were pumped up by the exchange. Those on her debate team had hoped Hillary would get the chance to bring up the Machado episode, but they had no idea exactly how hard the punch would land. When Hillary arrived backstage, she was greeted with a chorus of huzzas from her debate team. But it wasn't until Sullivan, the resident pessimist, gave his reserved assessment, "I think you won," that the victory really sank in. In Brooklyn, the mood was a little more anxious. Her data-focused aides thought she'd done well, but this was the election season in which the insiders were almost always wrong about public sentiment. Time and again, Trump had looked buffoonish in primary debates and won over GOP voters. So in Brooklyn, Hillary's aides waited for numbers from dial tests, real-time measurements of voters' reactions to the candidates, to assess how she'd done. It wasn't immediate, said one aide, who described a more gradual shift in the recognition that Hillary had stabilized a floundering campaign. The mood within 2 or 3 hours after it was really ebullient. There was no such hesitation in Washington Republican circles, where Trump had been seen as gaining steam before Hillary introduced Machado to the country. At that particular point, we had the momentum, said one GOP official. In an instant, it was gone. Trump's poor debate performance and Hillary's mastery immediately convinced the Washington establishment that a fundamental shift in the race had taken place. Hillary had looked presidential, and Trump had shown himself to be less than that. The debate had gone so badly for Trump that, as Raines had so presciently predicted in a prep session, he resorted to complaining about his microphone in the post-game spin room. It was fine, he said of the debate. Inside, he was furious. And, as was his wont, he focused intently on an opponent he felt he could defeat, Machado. As he had with Kazir Khan, he went after her with a fury. She gained a massive amount of weight, and it was a real problem, he said on Fox the next morning. In the hours after the debate, he demanded that his campaign and other Republicans go after Machado personally to undermine her credibility. On conference calls that week, Trump campaign CEO Steve Bannon shouted into the phone that the party needed to do more to defend the nominee and hammer the beauty pageant contestant. But few others in the GOP wanted to be associated with fat and slut-shaming Machado. "The Machado stuff was just unbelievable," said one source who listened in shock. "People are screaming on conference calls to engage on this stuff." On the other end of the line, Republican communicators cringed. It wasn't just bad political strategy, in the traditional establishment thinking, to trash Machado. A repeat of Trump's distracting personal feuds with Judge Gonzalo Curiel, Kazir Khan, and Megyn Kelly, among others. But it was just plain distasteful. For 3 days, with the Machado moment dominating political panels on cable news channels, Trump was forced to stew in the juices of his own failure. He'd had a chance, with Hillary cratering in the polls, to prove himself presidential. Instead, he'd looked sullen, and voters had been reminded of his mistreatment of women and Hispanics. He'd choked, like one of the losers he'd dispatched in the Republican primary. Unable to sleep, incapable of controlling his id, he tapped out a message on his Android phone shortly before 3:30 a.m. and hit the tweet button. Then he did it again and again. "Wow! Crooked Hillary was duped and used by my worst Miss You. Hillary floated her as an angel without checking her past, which is terrible," he tweeted. "Using Alicia M. in the debate as a paragon of virtue just shows that Crooked Hillary suffers from bad judgment. Hillary was set up by a con," he wrote in a second 140-character character attack. And, he wrote, "Did Crooked Hillary help disgusting, check out sex tape and past, Alicia M. become a U.S. citizen so she could use her in the debate?" There wasn't really a sex tape, just a poorly lit scene from a Spanish-language reality TV show. Trump's targeting of Machado's character only deepened the fast-developing conventional wisdom that he had imploded just as he had gotten within striking distance of Hillary. "I never thought it was going to be a week of that. I don't think anyone did," said one Hillary aide who had watched her test out the line in debate prep. "No one knew he'd attack her on Twitter at 3:30 in the morning." Trump's trip into quicksand wasn't just a matter of which candidate was reacting worse to the debate. The Brooklyn Brain Trust tracked his poll numbers as they slid that week, just as they had after Trump had attacked Kazir Khan. Toward the end of the debate, Trump had left a few breadcrumbs to signal where he'd be heading the next time they met, on October 9th. "You want to know the truth?" he asked rhetorically. "I was going to say something extremely rough to Hillary, to her family. And I said to myself, I can't do it. I just can't do it. It's inappropriate. It's not nice. But she spent hundreds of millions of dollars on negative ads on me, many of which are absolutely untrue. It's not nice, and I don't deserve that." It didn't take a veteran tea leaf reader to know Trump was talking about attacking Bill over a series of allegations of sexual impropriety over the years. Now, cornered and flailing, that's exactly where he planned to land a punch. Chapter 18. Red October. A few minutes after 2:30 p.m. on Friday, October 7th, the U.S. intelligence community dropped a political bomb. The Russians were behind cyber attacks on the Democratic National Committee. In July, Robbie Mook had alleged just that, and that the Russians were doing it to help Trump. The Republican nominee's response had been to publicly plead with Moscow to hack emails from Hillary's private server. "Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing," he'd said at a news conference in Doral, Florida. In the same setting, he also said he wanted to have Russia friendly and indicated that he might accept Russia's annexation of Crimea, a move that had prompted the Obama administration to sanction individuals and institutions with close ties to President Vladimir Putin. The intelligence community report was a godsend, a piece of hard evidence upon which Hillary could start to really build the case that Trump was actually in league with Moscow. Putin might not be a communist anymore, but he was a Russian autocrat who came to power after a distinguished career in the KGB. This was the kind of spy thriller shit that would surely break through in the press. If the public saw Trump putting Russian interests above American sovereignty, Hillary's aides thought, the story had the potential to break his back. After all, in the Red Scare days, Republicans had portrayed liberal Democrats as un-American in unflinching terms. Shortly after the news broke, Mook summoned Jake Sullivan, Press Secretary Brian Fallon, and a new addition to the team, Public Relations Specialist Glenn Kaplan, to his office at the Brooklyn HQ. From there, they jumped on a conference call with aides who were working at a debate prep with Hillary in Westchester, so they could formulate a response from John Podesta. A few minutes after 4 p.m., as they batted around ideas for Podesta's statement, it would ultimately charge Trump with making apologies for the Russians, a loud commotion erupted outside Mook's office. Shortly thereafter, Christina Reynolds, the campaign's research director, interrupted the call to inform her colleagues of another explosion. The Washington Post had posted a video clip of Trump bragging that he liked to grab women by the pussy. Mook didn't have a television set in his office because he found the constant humdrum of cable news distracting. But he craned to look through the glass wall at a TV propped atop a filing cabinet. The video clip, an outtake from an Access Hollywood taping in 2005, was being played over and over. Neither Mook nor the rest of the campaign's top brass thought much of the video, which they hadn't yet experienced with the all-important audio. The Russian hacking story seemed like a much bigger deal. The Access Hollywood tape didn't divert our attention away from what we were doing at that moment, said one person who was on the call. At the time, nobody really appreciated it, another source said. We were convinced that the statement about the Russians was going to be the big deal that day. On any normal day, one of these two stories that had broken within 30 minutes of each other would have been the most important news in the political realm. But October 7th, 2016 was no normal day. It was the most unusual, portentous day of an incomprehensibly wild presidential election. At 4:32 p.m., WikiLeaks, the online purveyor of hacked and stolen government documents, published the first batch in a series of emails pilfered from Podesta's Gmail account. WikiLeaks announced the release in a tweet that was quickly and widely picked up by major media outlets. Bang, 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 three blockbusters, any one of which could alter the course of the campaign, pushed out in 2 hours. The first two seemed like sure winners for Hillary, but the WikiLeaking of Podesta's emails threatened to offset or even overwhelm them. The Clinton campaign wasn't entirely surprised by the dumping of Podesta's private emails. After the DNC emails were first leaked in July and posted on a website called DC Leaks, Democrats had done a forensic analysis of the documents to determine whether it was possible that any of them had come from a source other than the National Committee. They had identified at least one that plausibly could have come from the personal email accounts of either Podesta or longtime Hillary confidant Capricia Marshall. The day before the Podesta dump, DC Leaks published some of Marshall's emails, none of which were particularly damning. And in an opinion piece about the Marshall emails on the morning of the 7th, the New York Observer, the news outlet owned by Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, carried a harbinger for Hillary. It's one of several releases from DC Leaks in the past few weeks, in addition to the documents released by WikiLeaks and Guccifer 2.0, with more expected in the coming few weeks leading up to Election Day. Guccifer 2.0 was the screen name of a source claiming to be a Romanian hacker. After the election, U.S. intelligence agencies would conclude in an unclassified report that it was actually a persona created by Russian military intelligence hackers. And despite their awareness that more hacked documents were coming, Clinton's aides didn't know that batches of Podesta's emails would be released day after day from October 7th until November 7th, the last day before the election. Nor could they have imagined that the intelligence finding of Russian interference in the election would so quickly get drowned out by the combination of the Trump Access Hollywood video and the Podesta emails. Could you imagine a day so fucking crazy that no one gives a shit about this? One aide said of the October 7th intelligence report. Suddenly, the upside-down dynamics of the 2016 election came into sharp relief. A Russian attempt to subvert American elections got buried under an avalanche of more titillating news. That is the single most illustrative moment of what this campaign was, said another aide. Here's something Donald Trump did and said and was arguably disqualifying to a lot of voters. Something that could put the race away. But within moments, a factor related to emails comes around and puts the thumb on the other side of the scale. At the time, though, Republicans were scrambling to deal with the fallout from the Access Hollywood video, which pushed even the email story almost entirely out of the news cycle for the time being. Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz, one of Hillary's most vocal Republican critics, withdrew his support for Trump immediately, and several other lawmakers and Republican luminaries would follow suit as the story continued to dominate the cable networks over the weekend. Donald Trump should not be president, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice wrote on Facebook. He should withdraw. At the offices of the Republican National Committee in Washington that Friday afternoon, the Podesta emails were a lifeline. The Trump videotape was so compelling, the silver bullet you never find, as one GOP official put it, that there was little anyone in the party could do to counter it. That is, until WikiLeaks posted Podesta's emails, which included the elusive transcript of Hillary's paid remarks to Goldman Sachs. Unlike a targeted leak, the nature of the WikiLeaks dump, 2,000 private emails made available to all news outlets at once, meant that editors had to divert reporters to comb through them and find anything newsworthy. Once those resources were committed, the demand to publish something, and quickly, was high inside newsrooms across the country. Although the Goldman Sachs transcript wasn't as flashy as the Trump video, the Podesta emails tied into several of Hillary's major vulnerabilities. In particular, opposition research the campaign had done on Bernie Sanders, and Hillary's dream of open trade and open borders. Sanders had hammered her in the primary for refusing to release the transcript publicly. If she had nothing to hide, if she wasn't conspiring with Wall Street types to rig the system against the little guy, he argued, she would let everyone know just what she'd said. The issue spoke both to the question of whose interests Hillary represented and to her lack of transparency. Trump had been echoing Bernie's attacks on Hillary. So while the transcript was fairly mundane, its very existence showcased the flaws Bernie had identified and Trump had exploited. Beyond that, the posting of Podesta's messages reminded voters of Hillary's email scandal. In this case, as when the DNC's emails were hacked, she and the Democratic Party were the victims, not the perpetrators. But for many voters, the term email had become shorthand for her untrustworthiness. And ever since the primary, her trust numbers were horrifying, said one source who had seen internal campaign focus group data. The conflation of Hillary's private email server issue with the cyber attacks on the DNC and Podesta would turn out to be a much greater threat than anyone on her team understood at the time. And Podesta's emails, in particular, would become the kind of slow-bleed storyline that plagued her longer than the Access Hollywood video hobbled Trump. It wasn't one big medical episode, one of Hillary's senior aides said. It was a chronic disease. Republicans weren't sure how much mileage they would get out of it either. But it was something to throw into the political ether to cloud the Trump video. We just jumped on that, trying to get it into every story, the GOP official said. 2 days before the second presidential debate, and barely a month before the election, all Republicans could do was scrape Hillary while Trump gushed blood. Over the weekend, even after Trump issued a semi-apology for the video, there was serious talk in Republican circles about whether he could be replaced on the ballot. By Sunday, more than 24 prominent Republicans, including several members of the Senate, had called on Trump to step aside and let Mike Pence lead the party into November. Trump surrogates quipped privately that there weren't many of them left in an already small campaign to defend their candidate. And the headlines were brutal. Can Donald Trump recover from this? CNN asked. Is Trump's campaign over? A Politico headline blared. Days later, piling on to the lingering questions, the New York Times ran a story about how the Republican nominee had groped and kissed women against their will. Saturday Night Live imagined Hillary reacting to the tape by throwing a party at her headquarters and guzzling champagne from a bottle as Kool and the gang's Celebration played. It was ironic to the real staffers, who at that late hour on a Saturday night were sitting at their headquarters desks focused on the DNC and Podesta hacks. That was not, like, a joyful day, one of them recalled. We weren't like, yeah. People did their work. That's how RNC officials treated the situation, too. They put their heads down and tried not to get too caught up in the morale-busting moment. I don't know how many people were optimistic about winning, the official said. There was not a day in 2012 that was that bad. Through it all, Trump managed to ride out the storylines that had labeled him a womanizer. After he was pummeled for days, a Washington Post ABC News poll revealed that only 13% of Republicans and 38% of independents said they were less likely to vote for Trump because of the Access Hollywood video. The Republican nominee's campaign was discovering one hard fact, as campaign manager Kellyanne Conway would later put it. There's a difference for voters between what offends you and what affects you. That's why the most jarring and memorable video clip in modern campaign history, a tape that should have rattled the family values-minded Republican establishment to its core, couldn't put Trump away. Early in the campaign, Trump had said he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue shooting people and not lose a vote. Maybe he was right. You would think, in any other election, that would be the end of a candidate, said one veteran Hillary aide. It was a terrifying realization, but one that had taken hold in Brooklyn long before that moment. If the rest of his antics and insults hadn't suppressed his base, this tape wasn't going to do it. People already knew he was a womanizing piece of shit, a senior Clinton aide said. It doesn't change the narrative. The most spirit-crushing job in modern political history, managing the Podesta email portfolio, fell on the shoulders of Glenn Kaplan. Every morning for the full month before the election, the 44-year-old former spokesman for Senator Kirsten Gillibrand would put on his hipster-style black-framed glasses, roll out of bed, and come into the Brooklyn office, knowing that he and his team of as many as a dozen staffers would spend the day reading hundreds or thousands of Podesta's emails, looking for the needles in the haystack that would stick in Hillary's skin, and, more important, any hidden landmines that could blow up the campaign. His team toiled in an office dubbed the Room of Tears. On a massive whiteboard with wheels, Kaplan dutifully recorded each scandal storyline produced by the emails. It showed which staffer was working on which topic and whether the campaign had deployed talking points on the subject yet. Kaplan would roll the whiteboard like a ball and chain from one dreary meeting to the next. The vast majority of the emails, which dated back to 2008, contained little of interest. The time of an upcoming conference call or meeting and the like. But others held sensitive deliberations about campaign strategy and nasty comments about players in the Democratic Party. None of them, Kaplan knew, would help Hillary. All the new revelations could do was hurt. And they did, day after day after day. In one message, former Clinton Foundation executive Doug Band had called Chelsea Clinton a spoiled brat. Neera Tanden, the president of the liberal think tank Center for American Progress and a former Clinton aide, wrote in another that Hillary's instincts are suboptimal. A June 2015 note from Mook called New York Mayor Bill de Blasio a terrorist. And in a message with the dismissive air of Hillary's deplorables remark, communications director Jennifer Palmieri had noted to Podesta in 2011, before they worked for Hillary, that she wasn't impressed with elite Catholic Republicans. I imagine they think it is the most socially acceptable, politically conservative religion. Their rich friends wouldn't understand if they became evangelicals, she wrote. Palmieri and Podesta are both Catholic, but the message read as a stab at Republicans who chose Catholicism and all evangelical Christians. At a time when Hillary was struggling with working and middle-class white voters in Rust Belt states, the email was toxic. Philadelphia, Detroit, Cleveland, and Milwaukee are among the biggest dioceses in the United States. Even outside the major metropolitan areas, the industrial Midwest is full of white Catholic enclaves. For example, in Brown County, Wisconsin, where Obama and Clinton were supposed to have had their first joint appearance, more than 100,000 of the 250,000 people identify as Catholic. In part because they had fought through the private server scandal and the DNC hacks stories already, and in part because the Podesta emails didn't all hit at once, it took a while for Clinton and her team to appreciate just how much damage WikiLeaks would do over the final 4 weeks of the campaign. Sullivan didn't realize the extent to which the emails had bled into the public consciousness until a trip with Podesta to Hillary's Midtown Manhattan personal office. They were in a subway station when a stranger recognized Podesta and walked up to chat. For months, the two aides had made the same trek from time to time without incident. Now Podesta had become a familiar face. Fuck, Sullivan thought. If people are recognizing John Podesta on the street, this is breaking through. There was an element of mordant humor in the way the campaign's leadership tried to manage the fallout from a set of emails that one staffer described as the Rosetta Stone of Democratic politics. The emails, which included long chains that Podesta was just copied on, were a key to the encoded secrets of Hillary's strategy and the way she and her campaign dealt with fellow Democrats. Mook posted a sign over urinals in the men's room, advising staffers that they should treat passwords like toothbrushes and not share them. But the humor was a thin veil for the feelings rubbed raw when staffers read what their bosses and colleagues thought of them. And that's to say nothing of the reaction among Democratic officials outside the campaign who were targets of derision. After his email about de Blasio was revealed, Mook called to try to smooth over hurt feelings. I'm sorry I called you a terrorist was not something he ever thought he'd be saying to the mayor of New York, On the one hand, it was a challenge to keep everyone from tearing each other limb from limb. That was manageable, if uncomfortable. The harder part was finding a way to prevent the daily release of sensational, or more often, sensationalized, emails to drown out the rest of the campaign's message. The main tactic deployed by the campaign was to refuse to acknowledge the accuracy of the emails. That way, surrogates speaking for Hillary on TV could address any new details by saying they couldn't confirm their veracity and quickly pivoting to whatever the campaign's message of the day was. Still, that was a partial salve. The surrogates still had to talk about the WikiLeaked emails, which meant less time for bashing Trump and promoting Hillary. It wasn't just defense that occupied Kaplan. He and others on the campaign believed that eventually the news media and voters would put more emphasis on a foreign government tampering with American democracy than on the details of each Podesta email. They thought Russia's meddling would have better legs. As WikiLeaks published more and more messages, campaign aides came to believe that there was a big and telling difference between the disclosure of DNC emails earlier in the summer and the reveal of the Podesta rounds. Rather than a massive, untargeted one-time release, this time there seemed to be greater political sophistication in the slow-burn method of daily releases for the final month of the campaign, and the Podesta emails were presented in an easily searchable format. The biggest difference they detected was that WikiLeaks had seemed to acquire a close enough understanding of American domestic politics to time its releases and publish emails on days when they would have greater relevance in the news. It's clear the Russians have now weaponized WikiLeaks to try to influence the election, Kaplan thought. What can or should we do to tell that part of the story? The initial response, Podesta calling Trump an apologist for Russia, would turn out to be cautious, considering how long the story would stay in the news. But over the course of the final month, the campaign would try a variety of methods to force the media into giving more airtime and ink to the idea that Russia was trying to throw the election than to the contents of Podesta's emails. Hillary would raise the issue herself repeatedly in debates. We have 17